You guys ever heard of the marshmallow test? You guys ever heard of this before? You have? Yeah. Sounds what? Delicious. It does. It sounds delicious. So evidently in the 1960s, there was a Stanford professor's name was Walter Mischel, and he decided to do a test. He brought 4 and 5 year olds into a room, and there was a marshmallow on a plate. Okay. And he would tell them, you can eat this marshmallow now, or if you wait till I come back, I will give you 2 marshmallows. Okay. And so, so that's what the test was. And then they would leave, the adult would leave, and they were gone for 15 minutes. Now, surprisingly, it is a long time staring at a marshmallow. I love these pictures because, I mean, that's exactly how I would be, especially with the kid like this, just kind of going. And if you're curious, you can go on YouTube. There's several videos you can watch about this, and it's quite humorous. But amazingly, 1/3 of the kids were able to do it, which I was surprised about. I thought that number, 33%, that's high in my opinion, because I thought, how would you do? How would I do? Especially as a 4 and 5 year old. And maybe your vice isn't, marshmallows. I mean, although it's very appropriate today that Lynn brought Rice Krispie treats out in the foyer. So see, you can go grab some of them. And they're not just plain. They're like cappuccino Oreo or something like that. So, I mean, even more delicious. So how would you do if you were staring down your favorite thing? Like maybe it's a steak or a cinnamon roll or a piece of cake. Or maybe what you're more tempted by is a glass of wine or a margarita. Who knows, right? You can pick what your temptation would be. How would you do? How many of you think you could hold out? Anybody?
No.
I see some. I see some of this. I saw a hand that said they thought they could do it. How many of you are just like, doesn't matter, I might be all in. Depending on what's there, I'm giving myself to it. Yeah. But the question's not really how would you do, is it? Really, the question we need to ask ourselves is how do we do? When it comes to everyday living, when we have the things that we're tempted by, when we have the things that pull at us, how do we do resisting? How do we do demonstrating any level of self-control? So we're in this series, we're looking at virtues and vices, we're calling it playing with fire. And really, we have to acknowledge that this is probably the virtue that we really don't want to talk about. I mean, we don't want to talk about it for a number of reasons. Number one is because I think many times we know where we mess up in the area of self-control. But also, we kind of live in a time and a place where, by God, I'm an adult. And I've grown up, and I can make my own decisions, and I can do whatever I want to do, whenever I want to do it, and you can't tell me otherwise. I mean, that's kind of the language of the day, isn't it? I mean, if it feels good, do it. I mean, in fact, if you exercise any level of self-control, sometimes people will even look at you like you've had a third eyeball implanted on your forehead, like, what's wrong with you? Why would you do that? Just do what you want to do. And even that idea can be, wasn't something new just for us. But it's something that's been around for a long time, because even the Apostle Paul addressed it in his time. When he wrote to the people at the church at Corinth, he wrote this. He says, he's quoting them. This is a common expression of the time. And he says, you say, I have the right to do anything. And we hear that, don't we? I have the right to do anything. Now, this isn't the full thing. Don't worry, we're coming to the rest of it later. But this sentiment has been with us for a really long time. But today I want us to explore the idea of the virtue of self-control. Because I really do believe without self-control, and maybe not just as much self-control, that can give us the idea of, willpower. Let's talk about spirit control maybe a little better. But without this type of control in our lives, I really do believe we will find ourselves playing with fire in many ways. Now, as I said, we do have to acknowledge that we live in a culture of indulgence. We do agree with that, right? I mean, like, we look around us, indulgence. If it feels good, do it. Don't deny yourself anything, especially if it will make you happy in the moment. That's the sentiment that we hear. And with that comes this. If a little bit's good, a whole bunch has got to be a lot better, right? I mean, think about, as I thought about that, I thought about the onset of binge culture. I mean, I actually did a little research, you know. I mean, I'm old enough to have to remember when you had to wait until a new show came out next week. A TV series would last like 22 to 26 episodes. I mean, think about that. You'd spend half a year waiting for your favorite television show to come out. And then our friends at Netflix around 2013 decided to just take care of that for us. And they began to drop entire seasons of shows at one time. Now, let's just go ahead and have the moment of confession. Who here has binge watched a show before? Okay. I just said one. How many have you watched, Dave? No, I'm just kidding. I mean, and think about that behavior. We would hype ourselves up before it dropped. And then when it dropped, we would drop everything in our lives. We wouldn't feed our children. We wouldn't pay attention to our spouses. I mean, because we're here until this is done. And we would spend hours just sitting there binging on this. What's interesting is parents, we know the dangers of this type of behavior. No parent in their right mind, after coming home from Halloween, says to their children, no, please store that candy in your room. You know, right? I mean, nobody says that. Why? Because we know within about 6 hours, every bit of it would be gone. I mean, we know the danger there, but we have to recognize that there is a drive that can be formed in us that encourages us to never say no to ourselves, to take what you want when you want it. And notice how I'm saying that. There is the side that we could say, well, that's something that maybe sin inherently gives us, but we also have to acknowledge that is something that is continually, every day, being formed within us. Again, I say this, I think, frequently. We are all being discipled by something. A lot of times we are being discipled into indulgence. And usually when we stop to reflect on what's driving us, maybe moving us into this behavior, which we don't like to do often, we find things that concern us. We might find wounds and insecurities. Maybe false images of self or false images of God that our overindulgences are trying to drown out, to numb out, to compensate for. Usually our indulgences are driven by something deep within. And this does take us back to the willpower fallacy that I talked about week one that comes back into play. Because it would be very, you know, okay, I'm a child of the 80s. Who else? Come on, raise your hands. Yep, thank you. You guys remember, what'd you say?
Just say no.
Thank you. Go ahead, put the slide up. It's coming up there. Go ahead. There it is, right there. There it is. Works. If you were a child of the 80s, so if you don't know, that is Nancy Reagan. She was our first lady for President Ronald Reagan. And you know, most first ladies like to have an initiative, you know? And so for Nancy Reagan, her initiative was to get kids off drugs. She wanted to curb and combat drug use. And the campaign, as you can see right there, was just say no. That easy, right?
Yeah.
I mean, if you hear that, you guys hear me? Just say no. Self-control is solved. Thanks for coming today. You know, but as, I mean, even got the t-shirt, right? I mean, you can find that on eBay. But we know it's not that easy. We know it's not that easy. And here's what's crazy about this. Can we talk about overindulgence for just a moment? When has overindulgence ever worked out for you? I mean, ordering that decadent dessert after that delicious and very filling meal. It looks good, and in the moment, it tastes good. What does it feel like lying in bed that night? How does it feel like the next morning when you wake up? Do you still remember that? Yes. And usually our minds go to what? Shouldn't have done that. That was too much. You don't sleep well. You toss and turn and you wake up and you ask yourself, was that really worth it? And we could apply that same behavior, that same mentality to so many of the other things that we give ourselves over to. Binge watching shows. Has that ever left you feeling like that was a good use of time? No. Drinking or even overindulging in love or relationships. What's interesting is that we know we need self-discipline. We need self-control, but we find ourselves so resistant to it. As you can imagine, this idea, this topic, this virtue is not something that the Bible is silent on. In fact, we find it in the Old Testament many times. We find it in the New Testament many times. And we're reminded of its importance in our lives. And even, I think we're going to look at maybe see where it even can come from. But Proverbs is a place that really talks about this quite a bit, using words like restraint and discipline and patience. We read passages like this in Proverbs 17. The one who has knowledge uses words with restraint. What is that? Control, self-discipline. And whoever has understanding is even-tempered. Even fools are thought wise if they keep silent and discerning if they hold their tongues. Now, I don't like this one personally. I like to shoot off my mouth. Let's just be honest. I mean, I like for boom. Let me just tell you exactly what I'm thinking in the moment. Never really works out well for me. Usually ends up with Brent having to apologize. But look at this. I mean, it's talking about restraint in our words. How often do we do that? We certainly don't see that being encouraged in our culture, especially with online, social media. If you have a thought in your head, please share it with the world. No, no. The one who has knowledge uses words with restraint. There's self-control in how we speak and what we say. Here's another one. Look at Proverbs 16. Better a patient person than a warrior, one with self-control than one who takes a city. I mean, think about that. Think about that. It is better to have self-control than to be a warrior. What we think is strength and power, the proverb is saying, it's not really. Anybody can have a club. Anybody can wield a baseball bat. What it really takes power to do is to be someone in some level of self-control. Here's another one, similar to the last, Proverbs 25. Like a city whose walls are broken through is a person who lacks self-control. I mean, that's an interesting one, right? At times we hear a lot of talking about walls, but you know, in the ancient Near East, walls around a city were an absolute necessity. They provided security and stability. Without a wall, you were open to all types of enemies coming in and destroying you. And think about what the writer of this Proverbs is saying. This proverb is saying, essentially, they're saying that without self-control, you are a disaster waiting to happen. You are like an unguarded city, just open to anything to come in and just destroy you. And lack of self-control isn't just about behavior, though. It's also about who we are. It means being out of control, being that person that lives in chaos. Have you been that person before? Have you felt like that person before? What role has self-control played in that? And as you remember, we're looking at these things as virtues, things we should pursue, characteristics of our lives as we become more like Jesus. The late Tim Keller once said this, said, self-control is the ability to recognize and choose the important thing over the urgent thing in any given moment because within yourself, your desires are properly ordered. I love that quote. You see, because sometimes we feel so called to something, so pushed to something, that really clouds our judgment. It can cloud our discernment even, taking away our self-control. But what we hope as people who follow Jesus is with rightly ordered loves, with rightly ordered desires, that we hope that we can hold all these things with open hands so that we aren't compelled and pushed one way or the other. We allow the rightly ordered love to move us however we need to be moved. And here's one more. This one makes me laugh. It's Proverbs 25. If you find honey, eat just enough. I love honey. Too much of it, though, and you will vomit. Seldom set foot in your neighbor's house. Too much of you, and they will hate you. Wow. You like that? You know, just some practical wisdom there. But notice what it's saying. It's a call to moderation. But notice what it didn't say. It didn't say, honey is sweet, and doesn't it taste good? Don't eat honey! You see, somewhere along the way, I think we get the idea that if it's good, that if it brings us pleasure, then God doesn't want us to have it. We still struggle with the idea of a God who is a cosmic killjoy and think that if it's fun, God can't be in it. God can't be pleased with it. And let me just tell you, we are so wrong in that. Pleasure is not inherently evil. In fact, God created this world, a good world, for us to enjoy. I mean, think about that. God created this world for you to enjoy. You know, growing up, I just felt like most Christians were sour and unhappy about everything. That is not how God designed us to be. God created the world for our good pleasure, to enjoy it, to be a part of it. So I was thinking about that. I was thinking about, you know, as a parent, I love to watch my kids having fun, running around the park, riding their bikes, riding their scooters, whatever, you know, and saying, hey, Dad, hey, Mom, watch this, as they do something crazy. I love watching Julian at home as he's watching something or doing something, as he's sitting there, and he'll just get tickled. And he will just laugh, Liz knows, and he just gets this belly laugh. And there is nothing that makes me smile more than knowing my kid is having fun. Why do we think God would be any different? Why do we think God would look at you and say, stop having fun? You know, no. I mean, I think about, as I was walking into church today, I was thinking about our worship night, and I was thinking about just life in general. And I was just thinking, you know, we just need a little more celebration sometimes. We just need to party more in the Lord. And have a good time doing it because, yes, thank you. I mean, what do you think God does? What do you think his face looks like when he sees you dancing around, having a good time, enjoying his creation? I think he smiles. I think there's a passage in the Old Testament that says that God sings over us, you know, with joy. This is our God. This is the God we've got to get to know to replace these images of the killjoy God that just wants you to sit in here and look all sour and just be disappointed with yourself. God wants you to experience life, and he wants you to know pleasure within the limits that he's defined, with self-control. Because as we've already said, indulgences are not where it needs to be. A little bit of honey's great. Eat too much, you're going to be throwing up. Who wants to do that? The problem, though, I think for many of us is that, at least for me, let me speak for myself, is that we're just usually not satisfied with enough. As I said, if a little bit's good, a bunch has got to be better, right? Contentment seems to be this elusive dream that we're just not quite sure we even want. We hear about it. We think about it. We think, oh, that's a nice idea. But do we do enough to really pursue it, to get to that place? Even in the Garden of Eden, perfection. There was one tree that Adam and Eve were told to stay away from. But there was one tree that Adam and Eve really wanted. Isn't that kind of the human condition sometimes? In the New Testament, we see places where it talks about self-control as well. The Apostle Paul mentions it often. One place is in 2 Timothy 1:7. He says this, For the Spirit God gave us does not make us timid, but gives us power, love, and self-discipline. As Paul talks about it here, you almost get the impression that self-control is a good thing, an optimistic thing. It's not just about denying yourself. It's actually something, a gift that we've been given. Peter talks about it as well. Peter writes this. He says, "For this very reason, make every effort to add to your faith goodness, and to goodness knowledge, and to knowledge self-control, and to self-control perseverance, and perseverance godliness, godliness mutual affection." He goes on and on and on. But he keeps talking. He says, "For if you possess these qualities in increasing measure, they will keep you from being ineffective and unproductive in your knowledge of the Lord Jesus Christ." Think about that. Peter's saying that our overindulgence, that our lack of self-control can actually be a barrier to knowing Jesus Christ. Isn't that interesting? It can be a barrier for us to really knowing who Jesus is. And even going back to something else Paul said, when he talks about self-control, Galatians chapter 5, the fruit of the Spirit. The fruit of the Spirit is love, joy, peace, patience, kindness, goodness, faithfulness, gentleness, and self-control. And just so you know, there's many more passages we could look at. I could have brought many more in, but I think you get the point. Self-control is encouraged. A lack of self-control is foolish and can even prevent us from experiencing the fullness of God. But why? Why pay attention here? Are we just calling you to be like the kids in the marshmallow test, just kind of this delayed gratification, so that you get two treats instead of one? No, it's more than that. It's bigger than that. The benefits, the fruit of self-control is many, honestly. We can see some incredible things that grow out of a life marked by self-control. And probably the first, and even though it doesn't feel like it, it can even seem counterintuitive, is this: self-control actually leads to greater freedom. Now think about that for a moment. Self-control leads to greater freedom. How is that? Doesn't that seem like a paradox? Doesn't that seem not possible? Self-control leads to greater freedom. How could limiting ourselves bring greater freedom? Well, I'm quoting Tim Keller today. He had another great quote in his book, Every Good Endeavor. He wrote this. He said, "Modern people like to see freedom as the complete absence of any constraints. But think of a fish. Because a fish absorbs oxygen from water, not air, it is free only if it is restricted to water. If a fish is, quote, freed from the river and put on the grass to explore, its freedom to move and soon even to live is destroyed. The fish is not more free, but less free. It cannot honor the reality of its nature. The same is true in many areas of life. Freedom is not so much the absence of restrictions as finding the right ones, those that fit with the realities of our own nature and those of the world." Isn't that great? We lost a great mind when we lost Tim Keller years ago. That is amazing. Self-control doesn't limit us. Self-control brings greater freedom. That reality is that when we give ourselves over to our impulses with no restraint, we will find ourselves enslaved and destroyed by those impulses. Paul, in his writings, he talks about this as the flesh. And he's not saying your body's bad. He's saying it becomes a problem when we become captive to those desires. That's why Paul says this in Galatians 5. He says, "You, my brothers and sisters, you were called to be free. Do not use your freedom to indulge the flesh." Even that verse we referenced earlier in 1 Corinthians, where Paul was saying, "Hey, you guys have this saying, I have the right to do anything you say." And he finishes that by saying, "But not everything is beneficial." He quotes them again. He says, "You say, I have the right to do anything, but I will not be mastered by anything." You see, Paul is highlighting for something. We all surrender to something. We all give ourselves to something. The question is, will we surrender ourselves to ourselves and the basis impulses that we have, or will we surrender ourselves to God? You see, we have to lean into the paradox of self-control and see it not as a preventer of freedom, but the way to it. That's the critical piece. It's not a preventer of freedom. It is the way to it. And we probably could just let you think on that for a moment, right? Because that seems so counterintuitive. But I really believe this is kingdom thinking. This is Jesus thinking. It's not the preventer of freedom. It's the way to it. But wait, there's more. There's more benefits that come from self-control. It's also for the good of others. A little later in 1 Corinthians, Paul writes this. He says, I have the right to do anything. Again, he's kind of repeating himself. I have the right to do anything, you say, but not everything is beneficial. I have the right to do anything, but not everything is constructive. And then he finishes that up by saying, no one should seek their own good, but the good of others. See, Paul is reminding us, he's highlighting the fact that there is something greater even than your own benefit or your own freedom, and that is others. We aren't created to live in isolation and take care of only ourselves. We are communal people. Yes, Doug Pavey, I know that's hard to hear for both of us, but we are, I'm with you, my friend, but we are communal people. I'm saying that just as much to me as I am you. You know that. And that's what we're highlighting here. It's no different than Jesus telling us that the second greatest commandment is to what? Love one another. Love your neighbor as yourself. And this isn't a popular sentiment today. It wasn't then either. The Corinthians prided themselves on their freedoms. As Roman citizens, they had freedoms others didn't have. And in saying this, Paul is telling us that living for others will require sacrifice. When you make that conscious decision to self-control and put others ahead of yourself, to consider what it might take to share and model Jesus for others, it's probably going to mean you giving up something in the process. Sacrificing. Ooh, we don't like that word. But N.T. Wright, I don't have the exact quote, but he says something like this one time. He says, freedom isn't freedom to do what we want, but freedom from all the things that prevent us from being the person God wants to be and the freedom to serve others. That's it, right? I mean, it's not freedom to do what we want. It's freedom from all the things that are holding us back. So we see that freedom comes from self-control, and self-control is the benefit of others, but there's more as well, because when we exercise self-control, it also requires and builds our trust in God and His provision. You guys know in the Old Testament, there was this practice called first fruits. Basically what it was, when you planted your crops, when the first of the crops began to be harvested, you took those and you dedicated them to God, which was a very risky thing to do, because you weren't guaranteed that anything else was going to grow. But by taking what you had gleaned and harvested and giving it to God, you were saying, God, I trust you for what's to come. I trust you for the rest of my harvest. My livelihood, my existence, my life for me and my family is dependent upon you, God. Same thing the Israelites experienced in the wilderness. They got hungry, they cried out for food, and God said, all right, fine, here's some bread from heaven, manna. Here you go. But do you remember the requirements for manna? How much could you get? One day, unless it was Sabbath, the day before Sabbath, and then you got two. And miraculously, it didn't spoil. But if you got more than you were supposed to and you left it in the bowl overnight, you had the fun, waking up to the fun of maggots being in your house. Who wants that? Trust in God. Self-control requires trust in God. We need to learn to live as if God is sufficient. To exercise self-control and not give ourselves over to every indulgence shows that trust in God, in His provision. And then one other benefit too, I think, is this. When we exercise self-control, it shows that we are living for a larger story. This isn't all there is. We live with an eternal perspective. But when we give ourselves to every indulgence, we act and we live as if all that matters is here and now, and that's just not true. That's why in Hebrews it says, about Jesus, it says, for the joy set before him, he was able to endure the cross. That just seems stupid, right? Joy before him and the cross. That's because Jesus knew the cross wasn't the end. He knew Resurrection Sunday was coming. He knew that once he was elevated, he would be King of Kings and Lord of Lords. What's keeping us from living that way? What's keeping us from living with this eternal perspective? Yeah, there's momentary sacrifice. How could life be different if we lived as if the kingdom of God was real now and not just someday? Yeah. And we've kind of said this earlier, one benefit, one fruit of self-control is also once we do this, we do begin to see our loves become rightly ordered. We see our desires kind of shift and we find ourselves able to say yes to the things we need to say yes to. Because self-control, self-control isn't about saying no to everything. It's about having the inner strength and desire to say yes to the right things. That's what it's about. I mean, wouldn't it be nice to be faced with a decision and desires and to be able to approach them with the same attitude that Jesus did? And we could approach them to say, how would Jesus respond to this? How is somebody immersed in God's love responding to this? To be able to view these moments not from a perspective that says, what will I have to give up? But what will I have to gain? I was talking with a guy this past week, and he was just talking about how in his time with God, he kind of began to see that there was a shift in him, that many times when it comes to these type of topics, we look at them and say, what will I have to give up? What is this going to cost me? What if we shifted that? What if we changed that perspective and said, it's not about what we're giving up, it is about what we're getting in exchange? And I think that is important. In a culture that tries to convince us we need more, we need to overindulge, exercising self-control or spirit control through the Spirit of God, you can discover that you have enough, that you are enough. And this is the way we develop the mentality of gratitude and contentment. And we do that just by being with God. When we watch the news, it's easy to think about how terrible humans are or how we can find ourselves to indulge our basest desires. We don't have to talk about the Epstein files, but man, that's exactly what that shows, isn't it? Yeah. Self-control is not something we see modeled for us in the highest levels of leadership anywhere, usually. But why are you looking there anyway? As I said earlier, overindulgence dulls our senses. It makes us selfish and it makes us apathetic and it makes it more difficult to hear God when he speaks. And this is not about willpower. This is about formation. Who are you becoming? I'm not asking you to flip a switch and become self-controlled overnight because that's not how it works. Self-control is the fruit of formation. The fruit of formation, it is not behavior management. And let me just tell you, you cannot forget the importance of community in this. And let me just tell you one other thing. Liturgy is important. What is the liturgy of your life? What are you finding yourself, giving yourself to? What are the rhythms that you are paying attention to? That is just as important because practices shape you. What practices are you giving yourself to? And ultimately, when we talk about self-control, what we're talking about is exactly what Jesus lived and modeled and called us to. Matthew 16, Jesus said, whoever wants to be my disciple must what? Deny themselves, take up their cross and follow me. For whoever wants to save their life will lose it, but whoever loses their life for me will find it. Okay, I've said a lot of words today. Thanks for staying with me. Now I ask you this, what is God saying to you? What stuck out to you this morning? What hit you maybe harder than you wanted it to? Worship team, go ahead and come back. Let's just take a moment though, before we sing, to notice those things, to see if God might be inviting you to take a step towards self-control so that you might experience and enjoy him more.